The Thing in the Pit by Dennis Detweiler. 1977. Agent Alvin Bright was like his name, or so he liked to think. When he wasn't working on a particularly juicy piece of intelligence for the group, or performing audits for the IRS, he was tracking down leads in his spare time. Leads upon leads. The world was awash with them. Connections that intersected and bisected, that collapsed into circumstance or exploded into meaning. Bright was a man searching for intersections. He was correlating contents. He left it to others to close those loopholes. He jotted all the leads down in the same way, on a yellow legal pad in ballpoint pen. He carried it in a valise everywhere he went, along with his glasses and his badge and gun. To anyone else, his documentation of the mysteries of the world would look like gibberish. Any one notation, filling half a page and underlined, would take a handwriting expert to dissect. Bright's script was fast and dirty and looping, and the underlines ran over words and through letters, until all that was left was a mess that only Bright could really read.
Van Dusen family, Coffee Street, Van Brunt, still alive, deposits.
This last line, scribbled in haste, might be the last entry he would ever make, though he'd forgotten about it now. In his time in the organization, he'd seen terrible things, and most importantly, he'd learned not to want to see such things. Unlike others in the group, he never gained a taste for seeing the unexplainable. To others, it was a thrill, an addiction. Most likely one day it would lead to their death. To him, it was an equation. He would add it all up, and it would point to the truth. He would file his report and go home. He would not get involved. He would not try to shoot it or blow it up or even see it. He'd report and retreat, and sleep soundly knowing he'd done his job. Until today. The door shook again, and a rain of rust falling into his upturned eyes brought him back, squinting. The chain on the door squealed, the sound of a balloon being relentlessly clutched to the point of popping. He tried not to look past the door, to the shape past the door. But it was there. For one second, he saw the shape strain the door to its limits, a steel door. Planted in the earth before World War II by indifferent men. He could see them here, goggles on, acetylene torches burning, chewing gum and thinking of the dwindling American dream. Past the black gap where the door hung at an angle, still shut for now, was a green eye, flickering in the half-light of the ancient yellow bulb like a huge firefly. The eye was large. It was, if one were to place it on a tray to measure it, 2.5 inches across. The eye was alive and connected to something that longed for his blood. It was 326 years old. Though he did not know this, Agent Bright knew this. Once, earlier, though he'd no idea when, he'd screamed and pressed his revolver to the gap and had worked the trigger 6 times, deafening himself and using up the last of his ammo. So much for being like his name. He'd screamed for a long time, and the only reason he had noticed and stopped was because his throat began to throb and shriek with pain. He was so deaf he hadn't realized he'd been shouting, even after the gun was emptied. Who knew how long that had gone on? His watch had been smashed in the fall. Then he sat in the dim light and hitched his breath in huge gasps, each one ripping his throat with razors, eyes on the door as it shook and pounded, bent and was pulled, until the stainless steel around the handle began to crease. He wept there as well. But time was jumbled. He could no longer discern the order of things. Trapped 200 feet beneath Brooklyn, in the dark, and no one knew where he was. Bright, like his name. Before all this, a door had opened for Bright on a wizened old woman, clad in a white nightgown that hovered around a body but did not touch it, causing her to look strangely bloated. But the face which hovered over the yellowed lace collar was small and frail, and it bobbed like the head of a chicken, goggling at the light. A waddled neck wasting away with old age. Sunken cheeks and avid eyes, which were an odd shade of green. "Good morning," she said, in a voice like a grandmother's. "Hello, Eloise Van Dusen," Bright said, managing some authority.
"Oh, yes, hello. Is there something I can do for you, young man?"
"I'm Agent Alvin Bright, IRS." He held open his badge very close to her face. I'm here pertaining to the ongoing audit of the Van Dusen Shipping Company. Are you Eloise Van Dusen?
Oh, yes, of course. We have been expecting you. Do come in.
She'd opened the door readily, her face filled with a smile of yellow teeth. Outside, Red Hook continued to fall apart, but in New York in the 1970s, decay was the rule, not the exception. The old woman shut the door on the sunlight, and Bright entered an ancient home of warm wood, frayed rugs, and dim shadows, filled with strange smells. He thought nothing of the house at the time, but if he had, for no clear reason, it might have reminded him of a funeral home. "Would you like some lutefisk?" she said, brightening, crossing to a vast chipped tile kitchen. It had enameled and stainless steel restaurant-quality stoves. Bright had done an audit or two on restaurants to know the difference. The room smelled of charcoal and vinegar, clean, but with an undertone of meat.
Oh no, Miss Van Dusen, he replied, dropping his valise on the formica table, some remnant of the '50s, and pulled out his legal pad.
It is Mrs. Van Dusen, if you please, she said. Without turning, she took a slight curtsy.
Oh, excuse me. I understand your husband, Pieter Van Dusen, has been deceased for some time.
She smiled and placed a solid silver tray filled with crackers covered in grey, slimy flesh on the formica table.
Yes, yes, but it is like my Pieter is still here sometimes, you know.
She placed a fish-covered cracker on a small china plate in front of him on the legal pad and eyed him. Bright hesitated and then brought the cracker to his mouth in one quick motion like a man gobbling an aspirin. He didn't even really chew it, just swallowed. He was not used to hospitality. He felt he needed to eat it, even if it took a sheer act of goodwill. His mouth burned a bit, and the taste was like something which had been pickled but had gone over. It put him in mind of rotting yellow things growing out of the light. And for a moment, before he held still for a moment and steeled himself, it almost all came up, out his mouth, through his hands, all over the table. Then it dropped down his throat and into his roiling stomach. She watched all of this with great interest.
Delicious, he managed, sitting down.
Her laugh was like yellowed paper, crumpled in an empty room.
Mrs. Van Dusen, we're in the last stages of our investigation into the Van Dusen Shipping Company, 139 Coffee Street, Red Hook, Brooklyn, and I understand you're a paid employee of the company.
She sat with some effort, perching on the chair like a frail bird.
Yes, I am of the board, and am paid a salaried wage.
My husband saw to such things, she chirped, and waved her hand.
And what year did you join the board? Bright scribbled down.
Salaried board member E. Van Dusen.
Oh, that would be 55. Then she started. Oh! And Bright jumped.
Tea! I have not offered you tea, she said.
She slowly, improbably rose, and Bright found himself put off. She'd moved away before he could adjust to the idea of it. She entered a big, wall-sized door with heavy metal latches, a dry storage, and shuffled inside.
No, Miss Van Dusen, that's fine.
Nonsense, nonsense. She puttered back and forth from the old stove to the sink and prepared the kettle. He watched her. The floor creaked and moaned under her shuffling steps. Bright's mind wandered as he watched her feet. Finally, she was setting a cup of greenish steaming tea on the table. She slowly sat down again.
None for you? He asked.
Oh, no, 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 she laughed. My bladder is not what it once was, if you'll excuse me for saying so. She laughed and waved a hand around like she was swatting an invisible fly. They talked of nonsense and bank accounts and dates of death and birth. Time unraveled and spun out. He found the edges of the mystery discovered on paper, and something took over. He pulled in the trail and wound it. He looped and danced with her and backed her into corners and let her go to run out the line. When he became tired of the game, he said, "What about this bank account at Rensselaer Bank? Who's the man who deposits funds there once a month?" She looked at him with a squint.
"What man?"
He smiled and opened his valise and slid across a deposit slip.
"Is this your signature?"
She fumbled for glasses from within her nightgown and placed them on the end of her nose and hung her mouth open, glancing at the document. She picked it up. It was a slip for the withdrawal of $5,000. It had an unreadable male signature and the looping, careful scrawl of Eloise Van Dusen beneath it.
Yes, she finally said. Her mouth was a wrinkled slash.
Well then, why don't you tell me who the man is? And I would note, faking one's death is a very serious offense. Bright sat back and smiled.
He's my husband, she said, without any real resistance, and stood frailly.
I see, Bright said, and leaned down to remove a tape recorder from his valise. The smugness in this move, the feeling of control he had at that moment, that would haunt him during his time in the hole. While Bright fumbled with his valise, she placed the glasses down and walked around the table. He glanced up, not really interested, but that attitude changed quickly when she grabbed his shirt and yanked him up to his feet, off his feet, and the tape recorder's bulk slipped from his hand and shattered on the tile floor in clattering plastic. Buttons popped on his shirt, and the long, low sound of a seam letting go on his jacket swept up his back. He flailed like a fish pulled from the water on a hook, his shoes found no floor beneath them. His hand locked on her hand, and his eyes found hers. Her mouth rolled back over teeth that went on and on. The cheeks drew back and just kept going, pulling up until her eyes were nothing more than slits which caught the light as red lines. She looked up at him like a prize. When she held him up close, he could see her angles were all wrong. She was smaller than him, but somehow not. She held him with one frail arm, and he dangled, and his mind kept struggling, saying his feet should be on the floor. Her arm doubled in his vision. Another seam let go, and he began to slip down, but she tightened her grip, and he felt claws settle into his flesh and press forward until his skin popped and blood began to trickle down his neck. Talons. A smell filled his world. Wet fur. Rot.
You are a very, very clever young man. But not nearly as clever as Ms. Eloise, she said.
Her voice explored a deeper register and rumbled in her tiny chest with the improbably low sound like a lion purring. He realized it was laughing. He had locked a hand on hers, and his fingers felt short, stiff fur and the knobs of rough bone beneath thick armored skin, bone spurs and warts, and skin like a rhinoceros. He tried to scream. She tightened the hand he could not see but only feel, the monster's hand, to choke him off. She walked across the kitchen, the floor groaning and sagging beneath their weight, his feet never touching the floor, towards the pantry door. She stepped in and yanked the light cord, and the naked bulb lit the room, swinging madly, rocking and clattering. The crazed shadows shifted and swung, and it was difficult to see, but something about her shadow was not right. There was no old woman there, but the bulk of something ape-like. Huge and furry and holding him aloft like a feather, something with the snout of a jackal, and the shadow spray of uneven, shovel-like teeth launched from its face at bizarre angles. Then her grip tightened more, and his vision blurred. She crossed the room to the ancient, tank-like refrigerator and shoved it with her other arm. The huge steel bulk of the refrigerator shot backwards and tilted back a little with the force of the shove, before dropping back forward with a thud that shook the room. 400 pounds at least, oh my God, he thought. At the edge of his vision, he saw a hole in stone the size of a well, scrabbled and dug by a million claw marks the refrigerator once covered. His neck sang, and rivulets of blood soaked his shirt. Her arm brought him up over the hole, and warm wind wafted up, ruffling his hair. He kicked and struggled, but the old lady thing didn't even move. His mind said she could not be doing this, but reality resisted the commands of predictable physics. You'll excuse my poor temper, but I dislike questions and talking over much, the thing pretending to be Eloise van Dusen croaked, and shook him once to get him to open his eyes. She swam in his vision. The old woman, the illusion, the monster. You'll find my husband much more forthcoming, she said. He hardly ever shuts his mouth. And then he was falling. He struck the side of something metal in the dark once, which arrested his fall for perhaps a second, and tumbled a moment before landing with a bone-shaking crash in water. He had no idea how far, but the fall felt eternal. When he hit, his head struck cement an instant after his landing, a rebound. One hand landed beneath him and twisted back painfully. Water shot up his nose and in his face and all over his clothes. His face vibrated and felt fat and hot, even as water spilled down it. It smelled of rot and shit and piss. His ribs up one side of his chest shrieked with pain with every hitching breath. He pushed himself up on one arm and looked around to find himself in an oubliette of cement. He found his pistol then, wet, and held it up out of the water. He struggled to his feet unevenly and wavered there, eyes adjusting to the dark. Suddenly he was struck in the shoulder behind his head from above by something hard and heavy, like a hammer, and he dropped his gun and stumbled forward, almost dropping to his knees. In the dim light, he saw the ruins of the tape recorder jutting from the water. He scrabbled and retrieved his revolver, shook it off and glanced around. He tripped and almost fell forward again, but flailed his arms and kept his balance. His foot had struck a pile of ruined rebar, fused by rust, time, and water. He went around it. There was a mechanical click, the sound of an electrical connection. A red light beneath a mesh of steel lit next to a half-open steel door he could now see. A klaxon began to burr, reflecting in the dark in time with the light, which went on and off. Each sound deafened him and echoed. "Dinner time, my love! Dinner, dinner, dinner!" the Eloise thing shouted from above, far away. He stumbled forward as the buzzing stopped and found the old submarine door. He pushed it shut, but found it had no latch. Just a hole punched through the frame and door which once held a lock, now long gone. The heavy door slid back open in his grasp as he released it, left hanging open like a gaping mouth. Something was coming. He heard it beyond the gap. He felt it. Bright reached down to the door and his hands settled on wet, flaked metal. He cut his hands but came up with about 2 feet of red rusted chain, wet and ruined. Shaking, he worked the chain through the slots in the door and pulled it shut with a squeal that set his teeth on edge. Then, back to the pile of rebar, he shoved the pistol in his pocket and plunged his hands into the watery pile and pulled a piece free where it shook in his hand. Bright ran back to the door and slid the rebar through the loops of the chain and spun it, causing a horrific screaming shriek, which finally brought the door tightly shut. Everything, from the discovery of the door to the shutting of the door, took perhaps 15 seconds. He removed the pistol from his pocket. A moment later, a monster. Now, out of ammo, leaning against the door, shutting out some horrible snuffling monstrosity, Bright wept. This went on for some time. Finally, beyond the door, a reasonable voice. An old man, quiet, no roaring or growling or snarling. The smell remained, but the voice was so convincing and quiet that it filled him with ice. "Open the door, if you please." Bright leaned over carefully and looked to the slit. A small, bespectacled man stood in shin-deep water, goggling in the gap like a little bird. Like the old woman thing above, Bright knew what he was seeing was false, but he could not unsee it. "No," Bright said, a whine. It was the man from the photo at the bank. "There really is nothing to be done, my young friend," the old man thing said, quite convincingly. "No one shall find you here, I'm afraid." Silence. There was a sudden slam on the door, something strong enough to snap a wooden door in half, but the steel held. The door shifted a quarter inch in the frame, and dust and rocks fell from above to plink in the water. Bright screamed and dropped his gun as his back bucked forward from its weight. The gun vanished in the stinking water. He looked to it and shut his eyes. What did it matter? It was empty anyway. Not even a round left for himself. This went on for some time. Occasionally, the thing beyond the door tried to talk to him. Bright didn't listen to the gorgon past the door. He placed his hands over his ears. Sometime later in the dark.
"Let us suppose something, you and I," the old man voice said. "Let us say there is a kind of being which is immortal, that feeds on the human dead. Let us say that these beings otherwise wish to be left to their own devices. But we are become fast friends. I am of this kind, as is the wife, as you have guessed. We may look like anyone we feed upon, and if the mind is
fresh and alive when we feed on it. That mind might live on in our minds. Dr. Albrecht, the body I wear now, is still here, despite his death in 1927. I recall all of his life. His hopes, his thoughts and dreams remain in my mind, alive. Limited immortality, to be sure, but immortality, nonetheless. They will remain with me forever.
Bright lay half in the water, exhausted, and listened, eyes wide. His mind rose and sang like madness, a million thoughts rushing out from a single source, vanishing into impossible places, fast.
Now, suppose a man was stuck in a cage with an immortal being outside. An immortal being who feeds on the dead. Who may wait forever. What I'm saying, and poorly, it seems, is this. Would you like to starve to death, young man, or to live on in whatever manner is possible?
Bright's breath stopped.
You chew on that, and I shall return. Feel free to explore the tunnels at your leisure. It's of no consequence to me or mine.
Bright lay on his back in the standing water, watching slight reflections ripple around him, breathing slowly. Hours had passed, or minutes, it was impossible to tell. The thing at the door was gone, or so it seemed. There'd been no movement or voice for some time now, though time was difficult to track. The light seemed ambient, like it floated in the air, dimly casting imperfections in the black in front of him, cutting shapes, forming walls and rocks and water. One thing was clear, even here, down in the dark, light from above ruled. Night had fallen above, and the myriad reflections which bounced and glowed and wound their ways down into the black had faded. Finally, with effort, he stood. His knees popped and his body screamed with pain as a million different bruises spoke out at once. He stood swaying, with his head held to the side to prevent the sharp pain in his back from growing to become his whole world, and looked around. He stumbled forward in the dark with his arms outstretched, fingers wide. He kept his center of gravity low, and when his feet struck solid stone in the water, he'd feel out the shape in front of him before moving on. Soon he'd circuited his cell, a standpipe, twice. It was maybe 20 feet by 15, filled with debris. There was the porthole door with its makeshift lock. And now he knew a small latch-like door in the back, away from the door. The door was the size of the door in a large stove. It was big enough for Bright to fit through, if he could open it. He focused his attention on this shape, with his raw, wet hands in the dark, and began to work it. The iron of the door was ruined and scaled, rusted from countless hours of water pouring over it here in the dark. He struggled at the latch, working it, shaking it, throwing his shoulder up against it, rocking it. Even after hours of this, or so he believed, he was uncertain it had moved it at all. The handle felt the same after all his efforts. Bright realized, as the light indefinably began to rise again in the air, that his hands were covered in black splotches, looking like the negative outlines of continents on the world of his skin. It was blood. His fingers had been chewed raw by the metal flakes, and he laughed as he found himself wondering when he had had his last tetanus shot. He laughed so hard he had to sit down.
"There is humor here, to be found in the dark," the old man said from outside the door.
"Go away, please," Bright said, laughter vanishing as instantly as it had arrived. Through his hands, the slightly darker shadow on the wall, the porthole. Beyond it, something not human.
"I am bored with the voices here, alone, in my head." "Tell me a new tale," the old man thing said.
Bright's mouth hung open. His hands came down from his face.
"No!" he shouted. The sound jumped back and batted his ears, flat and empty and metallic.
When it ended, the room was silent, except for the dripping of water, somewhere out in the dark.
"Very well, I tell you a story, boy." The old man laughed.
When he spoke again, it was a whisper. The story was practiced and easy, something it had spun in its mind so many times that it had worn clean like a river rock, black and heavy and smooth, without seam. Everyone in the town knew the keepers held secrets. In the end, it was what brought the boy to them. That and the hope of food and warmth. But the boy's life was not always a tragedy. Before the big man came, there were happy times that one might mistake for a childhood. The boy played with straw soldiers on the sill that overlooked a thin, cobbled road facing a picket wall. And in the winter, when he was still small, he snuggled in the bed with his mother, while rotten wood popped in a stove and belched smoke into the tiny space the landlord called an apartment. They lived on the Wall Street, and later, the big drunken man who worked wood and called himself his father came to live with them there, stretching the room to its limits. The big man was not his father. His father had put to sea a year after he was born, for London, and was gone now. Dead, by all account. Lost. His mother's suitor brought home pay, sometimes a lot of money in furred purses, with raw knuckles and bruises on his face, but he never smiled. He said very little, and what he said spoke of imperatives. Food, warmth, safety. Nothing else. The man was never untoward at home. He never struck them. He never yelled. All in all, the boy often thought, he could have drawn much worse a card than the big man. Still, it was like he wasn't there. Like the man and his mother lived alone. Like the boy was a ghost. More and more, the money the big man made was spent on wine and beer. His mother fell into the bottle with the man she grew to love more than the boy, and left the ramshackle house behind. The boy believed his mother had abandoned him because he'd grown to look more like his sailor father as he grew into manhood. The same red hair, same smile with wide, flat teeth. It hurt her to look at him as he changed into the drowned man she had loved. So first she drank, and then she left. One day, and he could not precisely say when, his mother and the big man didn't return, and he was left alone in the room above the picket. Giddy at first, the boy made wild plans that fell to nothing as time wore on and the loop of debt closed on him. Later, when the boy could not pay the rent, he left. The company put people like the boy in debt as prison, and a balance remained, so he fled north the day before the bill was due, moving outside the picket and into the woods past the edges of town. For a time, he lived beneath a cluster of storm-toppled trees and stalked the slop piles of an inn on the crossroads of the Broadway, eating ruined bits of vegetables and sometimes rotted meat he found there, if the hogs did not get to them first. He drank and bathed from one of the collection ponds, startling sheep when he splashed his face. At night, he collected berries near the fences of the farms, occasionally outrunning local dogs who chased him more for sport than anything else. Then, one morning, the summer and its fantasy ended. The boy woke shivering beneath a rotted horse blanket with ice in his hair. Soon, there would be snow, and he would die if he remained outside the town walls. All knew of the keepers. Their estate was well north of the town, off the Broadway, in a series of tangled woods cut with a single brambled trail. The keepers were odd. They wore cassocks like Roman priests. They were of many nationalities and languages. They rode no horses. They took in indigents and debtors, and the walls of their estate were high. Inside, it was said, they crafted wine or some such to sell to the company. Their actual trade remained vague, but their reach was rich and strong. Members' debts were forgiven. People who went there no longer worried for the company. They got on. Once joined, no one left the keepers. One night, when he could no longer take the cold in the trees, the boy walked to the walled estate down the brambled path and stood outside the gate, marveling at the pattern carved there lit by a bucket of burning pitch, an intertwining circle, triangle, and angles ending in ellipses split across the gap of the gate, hovering over him like an enormous eye. It had all been very carefully worked, in a way which suggested it was not only artistic, but that it meant something. Religious freedom in the colony was assured by the company, and it drew many from the fringes of Christendom, with gold to invest on the edges of the map and a desire for privacy. The keepers fled persecution some years before, and it was clear to him now that they had more than average reason. Theirs was some religious pursuit. But what did that matter? If there was a god, clearly it had no interest in the boy, even if he went looking for it. He knocked on the gate, careful to keep his hands from the grooves in the door, as if they could poison him by touch. Finally, the gate opened, and a voice called him in from the cold, into the dark. The Keeper's taught him much. There are secrets that you tell, secrets that you keep, and secrets that can only be found once, and then only alone. That night, the boy learned the last and greatest human secret. In so doing, he became something other than a man. You were a boy, Bright said, despite himself. He put his hands to his face to stop himself from saying more as the silence continued, and he tasted blood and metal in the breath on his palms.
I have been many things, but yes, I was once a boy.
When?
Time is unimportant, and I confess, difficult for me to meter. A miser with infinite coin ceases to count by ones, as they say. But now, perhaps you can see we are not completely unlike.
I'm not like you, Bright said again, shocked by the strain in his voice.
You are lost and desperate and without hope, no?
Go away, Bright whined. I'm not like you at all.
This is true, the old man crooned. You are like me only in the way an acorn that lies fallow, lost on some stony ledge with no purchase, is like an oak. That is to say, you might become what I am now. Or you can become like the residents of the other cell.
Bright's eyes flicked to the small door. Silence.
What are you?
If you let me pass the door, I will show you, the voice said quietly.
It was so calm and convincing. Bright felt his hands come up to touch the makeshift lock on the porthole.
No!
Bright stepped back from the door, stumbling in the dark until he found a lip of cement, and curling there, fell into a dreamless sleep, exhausted. Later, when the old man thing had left, Bright stood at the small door and stared at it for a long time. He tapped it with a small, wet rock, lightly at first. Hello? On the third rap, he heard something. A shuffling crackle, something moving on its own, on the inside of the door.
Hello?
He screamed. No response, no further sound. He wrenched a ruined steel bar, bent and wet, from the water when the dim light returned, and worked it beneath the fastener of the small latch door. He threw his weight against it, and pulling, felt it scream for a second as it shifted. His hands were puffed and raw and wet with blood when he moved them again to gain purchase. Again, he threw himself against it, and it shifted. The door it held shut was small, but not so small that he might not pass through it. He put his head down and took a deep breath. One more go. He leveraged himself against the bar, pushing with all of his strength and weight. A slow, metallic screech filled him with satisfaction. It was followed by a pop and then the ring of a deep metallic bell. The small door swung open, and bones spilled out. Hundreds of human bones. Leg bones cracked and split for the marrow. Smashed skulls. A rain of teeth and finger bones and ribs. So many, they swept out and down from the door like a snowdrift, falling into the water with a huge clicking splash. Chattering, sweeping, filling empty spaces, gathering, growing. He leapt back from the charnel wave and tottered and fell backwards, smashing down onto cement chunks in the water, not noticing a gash up his back. His eyes were wide in the dark and his mouth worked, but nothing came out. The hole in the wall was a gap filled with more human bones than a graveyard could ever hold. Soon he too would be there, he was now certain, once he starved to death. Old man laughter from the dark, from far away. At some point, he vaguely recalled, he reached up and slid the steel bar out of the porthole chain with a squeal, his arms rubber and his legs wasted sticks in wet cloth. It was the last movement he could possibly imagine achieving, the last effort. He slumped back at an angle, wasted, and collapsed. He had begun drinking the sewer water sometime in the last few days. Time was elusive down in the dark, but there was no food, nothing to eat, nothing. He watched his hands, raw and bloody, shrink and sharpen to skin-covered bone. The metal bar pulled his arm down, and his hand would not hold it any longer. It clanked and sunk into the water. The door popped open immediately, the steel chain scratching and dropping into the corridor. Silence and water dripping, settling. He saw his reflection in the dim light when the water stilled, and staring back at him was a skull with a scrub beard and eyes glint sunken into the shadows of his skull, trying to come out to be seen. Then red pinpoints behind him in the dark. The street was bleached by light on a fall day. It was New York as he had known it before, despite the changes. Bright knew where he was, but could not say how he had gotten there. Still, at the same time, he knew, or some part of him did, just as some part of him looked on in wonder. Strange machines clung to lampposts, buzzing and clicking. Cars of a kind he didn't know prowled the streets like iron sea creatures, finned and rumbling. He had restricted his wandering to the bank, and then only in the early evening. In and out to do human business in his human suit. Agent Bright stepped to the newsstand, and Agent Cassidy was already there, waiting, reading the post. She looked up and smiled. "You sick?" she asked. "Yeah, a bug," the voice said in his head, and he flawlessly mimicked it. "Can we get off the streets? I've made some real progress on the Red Hook thing." It was noon. There was no worry for the shadows giving him, them, away. 300 years was a long time to practice such things, but he could recall when 200 had felt that way. 100. Much had changed, but men, the unripened fruit, remained the same. Shadows and reflections were all that worried his mind. Cassidy was good, he knew. He knew everything Bright knew about her. But she was only human. The future opened in a way that he had no longer thought possible, like some curio that, when turned, spread like the jewel petals of a flower, or the best parts of the marrow when they cracked and glistened like ruby red shot through a tusk of yellow ivory. The best and most delicious feeling of his lifetime, of a dozen lifetimes, a million. The world today was confusing and loud and smelled horrific, but was fascinating. The things Bright had shared with him, the things his discarded kin, now his food, had accomplished in his time below the ground. Cars and machine guns and moonships. Soon, the keepers would all know more.
The Thing in the Pit was read by John Hancock and produced by Chad Pfeiffer and Chris Lackey in association with Witch House Media. The Thing in the Pit appears in the collection Delta Green, Tales from Failed Anatomies, published by Arc Dream Publishing. Copyright 2014 by Dennis Detweiler.